Today is September 16th with Rav Reichman at 12:50.
Okay, so the first thing, spirituality is a very fashionable term. How does Judaism view spirituality? Judaism is a view from African race society. Okay, now, spirituality, spirituality, I presume we're talking about experiencing a spiritual. I think contemporary society is talking about spirituality as referring to an experience. Now, experience, which I imagine that people talk about, is something which you have psychological, emotional awareness of some experience called spirituality. Now, in Judaism, first of all, it's not so sure that the individual psychological experience is necessary for someone to have a spiritual experience. In other words, according to Judaism, especially Hasidus, the Jewish soul, human soul, has many levels. According to Hasidus, there are five fundamental levels of the soul: Nefesh, Ruach, Neshama, Chaya, and Yechida. Now, the first three levels, Nefesh, Ruach, and Neshama, meaning the biological, emotional, and intellectual, these are three levels of the soul that the individual is aware of. He's aware of that. So, he could have, and any one of those three levels, something which you would describe as a spiritual experience. He could do something physical or biological, and that would be spiritual. He could have some kind of an emotion. That emotion could be a spiritual emotion. He could do something intellectual, and he has an intellectual awareness of this spiritual event. But according to Hasidus, the other two levels, the Chaya and the Yechida level of the soul, are levels which are many times, if not all the time, beyond human awareness. So in other words, I'm aware, people are aware of our three levels, Nefesh, Ruach, Neshama. But Chaya, Yechida, and not the Yechida level, these things can be experienced, we can be aware of them, but it's rare and it's not common. So, but on the other hand, that's on the one side. On the other hand, we could be doing things, in fact, probably every single thing that we do affects all five levels of our being. So it could be that, let's say, a person does a mitzvah, and this mitzvah he does without any experience of spirituality at all. It's very dry, very plain, very rote, robotic. So he doesn't really experience it nefesh, ruach, neshama. But the chaya yechida, which anyway are rarely experienced, they may be having an amazing spiritual nourishment from this mitzvah, which he's not aware of. So many times, so that's why we say that in Judaism, we say a person should do the mitzvah even without kavana. Because we paskin mitzvahs lo tzrichas kavana. Because the mitzvah has a spiritual meaning and an effect which is beyond our awareness and higher levels of the soul. So that's why, I think the first major consideration is that in general culture, spirituality must be experienced. For us, it could be experienced, and I imagine it's great when you do experience it, but it doesn't have to be experienced. That's a very, very important difference. Now, I want to say that I think that granting this truth, that spirituality is not identical with spiritual experience. However, there's no question in my own mind that the contemporary Jewish Orthodox life, especially in the modern Orthodox community, has neglected the spiritual experiences much too much. In other words, the emphasis has been on doing the mitzvah, getting the thing done, which obviously is a very important, but it's resulted, there's been an educational and a communal neglect of a spiritual experience. So we shouldn't, it's definitely a tremendous lack in the community, the fact that there's a dearth, there's a lack of spiritual experience. So we don't need the spiritual experience to make the mitzvah or the deed worthwhile, worthy, but we definitely need the spiritual experience just in order to practice the Torah and Judaism the right way. So, because it says, "Ula'avdo b'chol levavcha," it's supposed to serve God with your heart, which means that you have to have a heartfelt feeling, experience when you do the mitzvah, when you serve Hashem. So, to me, this is a great challenge that I think Jewish education, Torah education, must confront and really grapple with, and hopefully successfully bring the experience of the spirituality into people's lives. That's what I think.
I may go to a different question that would, I think, would be a good follow up. You know, number two is a good, I guess, is actually the one, okay, I was looking for.
An ancient charge against the Jewish faith is that it is karma's focus on the physical manifestation of halakha and right deeds. What's the Jewish response? How does one achieve such the observance of the physical commandments? Okay.
And I guess what I might add to that question is, apropos of what the Rav just said, is there ever, I guess, a tension between spiritual experience as described by the Rav and halacha, which dictates physical deeds? Is there a tension superficially, or is there a harmony at some level?
Well, the thing is like this. I think that, you know, everything in this world was created by God in a mirror way, in a double way. In other words, there's the good side and the bad side. There's no such a thing. Something exists and it's neutral. It's either good or it's bad, or I can use it for good or for bad. But there's no such a thing as something which is neither good nor bad. So the same thing is true about spirituality, or that experience of spirituality. There's a good spirituality. There's also a bad spirituality, because we have Avodah Zarah. So obviously people who served the idols and did the various cult rites, they had spiritual experiences, but they were bad. So the Torah doesn't say any spirituality is good. It has to be the right kind of spirituality. It can't be the wrong kind. Unfortunately, today we have a phenomenon in the Jewish world, and through that, the non-Jewish world, call it the cult of the Kabbalah. Now, the cult of the Kabbalah, there is ways of studying and learning Kabbalah which will enhance one's spiritual experiences. However, if it becomes a cult, in other words, the goal is the experience rather than what's right or wrong. You can get a wrong experience of the Kabbalah. So that's what, unfortunately, there's a phenomenon today of, let's say, expressed by Madonna, dressed in Natsnias, wearing tefillin, singing a song. This whole thing is just a paradox. It's just it's bad spirituality, because it reminds one really of the rites of the Avodah Zarah, where they had spirituality, but they mixed it with women, all kinds of terrible practices. So you have to be very careful when we go for spiritual experiences that we do it the right way. So that's where halacha comes in. Halacha is really a control system to make sure that we gain the spiritual experiences, but in the right way. If you go for spiritual experiences without halacha, you're literally playing with fire. You can get spiritual experiences, but most probably it's going to lead to very bad things. So that's the response. In other words, the logic and control of halacha is very important. The spiritual experiences are very, very important, but have to be controlled. And that's where halacha comes in. And that's what I would say for that. Now, the spirituality of physical commandments. Now, the thing is like this, that when we speak about spirituality, it's a function of a certain soul experience. Nefesh, Ruach, Neshama, Chai, Yechida. Now, the soul is and is not attached to the body. The Chai, Yechida levels are really outside the body. That's why we don't experience them so much. The Nefesh, Ruach, and Neshama, they're more in the body. But clearly, the soul and the body are really two different things. What the Torah is trying to say is that since God attached the soul to the body, so the soul can, well, the soul is supposed to, first of all, it's supposed to sanctify the body. The body of the person is basically neutral and not holy. And the soul, being holy, is supposed to share its holiness with the body. So this is, I don't know if non-Jewish spirituality recognizes that concept. They may think that I don't know what they think about it. The Christians, they felt that you could never really sanctify the body. So they wanted people like the nuns, priests, they're not supposed to get married, because they don't see how you can possibly bring spirituality into sex. But Judaism says it's a mitzvah. Who is supposed to have children? Kohen Gadol, Yom Kippur, must have a wife. So we think that if God put the soul into the body, that means that God knows, since He created us, that the body can be sanctified. Even though you might not think so, you might think the body is carnal, it's vulgar, it's very low, it's animalistic. That might be true as you start the struggle, but we agree it's a struggle. We concede it's a struggle. But we don't believe, like the Christians, that it's a lost cause, that it's impossible. We must restrict the body. We feel that you have to control the body and channel it. When you do that, you get a very special spirituality. It's a spirituality which permeates not just the soul, but the body itself.
So I think I guess before number three, I'd like to move on to number four.
Sure. Through the ages, various Jews were intended to address a lack of Sajid within Dejan. Two of the most recent Muslim Hasidus. What does Rav Eichmann see as the most important of these movements, and how should relate to these movements, their works, and their legacies? Well, I think like this, that think that both movements have, the most important contribution is that they've made people sensitive, and they've given people methods of how to get and gain the spiritual side of Judaism. Personally, I go for Hasidus much more than for the Musa. I've never really had a good teacher of Musa. So I've been exposed to it, and I don't know. I imagine I never had a good teacher, because some people do, though they think it's amazing. But I've always found that the Musa side was very demanding, let's put it that way. It was, I found it, using a Hasidic phrase, for coming from the side of Din. Coming from the side of Din, which is a very strong side of all spirituality. It's very demanding. So that's where I was exposed to it. So I never thought I could do it. So I thought that's too demanding for me. But when I came into Hasidus, I found Hasidus more on the side, let's call it the Chesed side. The Chesed side is light, more optimistic, more joyous, more singing. So it's on the side of the positive rather than the negative, as far as I saw it. So that's why I went personally for the Hasidic side. Now, I might be wrong. I think that in general, today, Musar has become much more Hasidic than it ever was. I think when you go today, you hear a Musa shmooze, so very likely in the regular yeshiva, where there's a regular shkiach who teaches Musa and so on, you will find many times he's using Hasidic sources. They like to use the Sas Emes, Sheim Mishmua, the Hasidic books, which are more organized and has the Lutfak, the Hasidic yeshivas think in more of an organized fashion. So they bring that in a lot today. So they also have moved from the Samba Morose Din into the optimistic Hasidic point of view. So it's probably today much harder to distinguish between the Muslim and the Hasidus because of communications, they've merged. But when you read today's contemporary Musa Sfarim, it sounds very Hasidic. They really changed a lot from when I was first exposed to it 40, 50 years ago. At that point, they were coming from Europe. I heard the Bali Musa from Europe, and I found it very strong medicine. Today's Bali Musa are much sweeter. So, call it whatever you want to call it, Musa Hasidus, but it's the bright, light, optimistic sign, which is what talks to me, and I think it talks to the general public today more than the strong, demanding side.
Let me now move on to question three.
Three, a common committee that has lived after years in Israel to maintain, you know, the white government doesn't have anyone who experienced this. Okay, it's a difficult question. It's a difficult question to say.
That's why they're not interviewing me.
Right. Well, I personally think that you have to be very innovative. If you're going to wait for the YU to do it, you're probably going to become very disappointed. You have to be innovative. It means you have to be able to, let's say, for example, Rav Wolfson, he came here last night. So the boys, a lot of boys, hundreds of boys, heard, probably for the first time in their life, a great Hasidic master talk in a way which was so inspiring and so uplifting. So now, what's going to happen next? If a boy says, well, I'm going to wait for the next time Rabbi Wolfson comes to YU to get that kind of inspiration, he's going to probably have to wait a very long time. He may never come back. At most, he might come back next year, once. Once a year is not enough. But if you're innovative, you say, hey, Rabbi Wilson so inspired me, and he has a shul in Brooklyn, where I hear there's a lot of inspiration every Shabbos, I'm going to make it my business to go to that shul once, twice a month, and I'm going to find out how to go to that shul, how to get there, so on and so forth. You have to be innovative. You have to be able, if you got such inspiration from Israel, so then between terms, you go back to the yeshiva in Israel, learn it in the summer, you go back to Israel. But a person will spend, even when he's more you, if he could organize it that he would spend 2 months a year in Israel, that would be a tremendous dose of a maintenance to maintain by doing things outside YU. That's what I'm saying. Now, within YU itself, which is where people are spending, you know, almost all their time, you have to look in YU, where are those pockets, where are those places within YU which can help me maintain and hopefully climb the ladder to have more Avodas Hashem. The first place is the Beis HaMedrash. You have to, a student has to maximize his time in the Beis HaMedrash. He has to. It's spiritual survival. If he's going to minimize his time in the Beis HaMedrash, he's literally shooting himself in the leg. If he maximizes it, then he can do okay, he can do well. That's where he has to be. If he's going to be spending less than maximum in Beis HaMedrash, he's going to have, unfortunately, a reader. If he maximizes it, which means doing everything he has to do there in the morning, number one, get there on time, stay there on time, do the whole thing, the whole 10 yards. He has to go to shiur every day, you know, do whatever he has to do according to the schedule. That's they call it getting to first base. Then he must go at night to the Beis HaMedrash. He has to. That's voluntary. But he can do it. Now, if he says, well, my schedule doesn't allow me, then he should change his schedule. I don't believe in the 16, 17 credit college course schedule. You take, I myself took 6 years to go through college.
So would Rav Reichman recommend doing the extra fifth year that the yeshiva offers?
Absolutely. Everybody should take the fifth year. You should take, I think that you should take 9 credits in the college, 3 credits of shiur, or if you're already maxed out with your Jewish studies, so you take 12 credits in the college. You should never take more than 12 credits of secular courses. This way, you'll have the time to go on the base membership at night. Now, a guy, I can say from experience that boys who do the maximum, which means they do the whole morning where they're supposed to, which is basically the Medrash, Seder, and the Shir. And they go into the Beis Medrash every single night, for at least an hour. Those boys do it very well. But the ones who don't do that, they many of them fall. So I think going outside YU to find spiritual inspiration is a great thing, but it's probably, since very few people do that, you know, I know a few boys here and there do that, and they do nicely with that outside, but 98% are here inside. Inside you must be in the base of Medrash. That's really the only thing. The second thing in YU is to attach yourself to a Rebbe. Because the Rebbe, he's basically a whole day in Torah. So he himself is totally immersed in Avodas Hashem. Torah, mitzvahs, whatever he's doing. He's not studying secular courses. So he is a very holy person in comparison to the average student because of how he spends his day. So if a Talmud attaches himself to a Rebbe, so you know, it rubs off. And I was here as a student, I attached myself to Rabbi Soloveitchik, the Rav. You see his picture here. So So whatever he did for himself rubbed off on me as a student. So it's very good. There's nothing wrong with a big candle lighting a small candle. But I think that the disaster and the failures come from the boys who violate these two things. They don't maximize their base medrash, and they have no levy. If you don't have both, boy, you probably have a very big fall. If you do both, you should do very well. You can do very well. If you maximize base medrash and you attach yourself to a Rebbe, you can do very well. You can do even better than Israel.
So I guess the next question that I would want to move on to then, apropos of that, is, I guess we're up to question number 5.
I think it's like this. You know, there's a theory and there's an experience. So we spoke about before at the beginning. There's a spirituality which we experience. There's a spirituality which I know theoretically is involved in what I'm doing, but I may not experience it. Because we spoke, the soul has other levels, higher, yechida. So when you get into secular studies, to experience spirituality while I'm doing secular studies is going to be a challenge. It's possible, but not very likely unless there's an effort to do that. Most probably, the average person who does secular studies is going to have a secular experience. It's not going to be a Torah experience. Let's say he's doing mathematics or reading English literature, you're not going to have a total experience. I think like this. First of all, you have to be able to see it, at least intellectually, as a broader part of my Torah being. Let's say you look at it as a way of parnasa. Only very few people will or are expected to make their parnasa from Torah. 1 out of 100, let's say. So 99 out of 100 are going to have to make their, are now expected to make their parnasa outside Torah. So what you have to say is, first of all, intellectually I know that God put me into this world, and I see from various experiences that I from the 99. If a person has a possibility that he's from the 1 from the 100 who should and could spend his whole life learning Torah, teaching Torah, making parnasa out of Torah, then he definitely should go that way. Because that's definitely like taking a sure path to a spiritual goal. So certainly somebody who has, you know, he sees, he feels that that's a path that he could do successfully, he definitely should go that path. But the 99 people, and I say also like this, if a person even has a suffix, he doesn't know. Maybe he could make Torah his career. Maybe he can't. He has a suffix. I say he should try it. Because it's like Pascal's bet. Sometimes you make a bet where you can only win and you can't lose. So let's say a guy puts 5 years into learning Torah. After college, he goes to the smicha program, and he sits in the kollel. So he put 4 or 5 years, and then it turns out he goes and tries to get a job, can't find a job. Or let's say he tries for 1 year to be a teacher of Torah, and he's not a success, so he has to leave the field. But he won because he got 5 years of Torah learning, serious whole day Torah learning in the Smicha program. So I say, even if you have a suffix whether you could do it professionally, you should definitely try it. Because you can only get 4 or 5 years of serious Torah and spirituality. That's number one. But now let's say, and personally I think that that gets us from the 100 people, really at the end, only one person out of the 100, I feel, will wind up with Torah for the whole life. But let's say from the 100, I think 20 could think, maybe I could do. Let's say 20 do this for 5 years extra life. The 80 other people, they say, I'll never make it. I got to go make a living. I have other considerations. So even from the point of view of plain panasa, but you know intellectually that it's part of my Torah life. Because God made me a certain way that I have to be the ish yotzeh hasada goes out, but I have to understand that that's Hashem's ratzon. So Hashem wants me to do that, so that's a mitzvah in a certain way that I'm supposed to do this. Of course, you know, a guy makes a living, he supports his wife and children, so he's right away doing a mitzvah of taking care of a family. That's a mitzvah. So you have to look at it certainly intellectually as a mitzvah. Not that you're a second-rate citizen, you're guilty of failure. You're not a failure. You have your mission. Your mission is to do Kiddush Hashem outside the Beis Hamikdash. So you have to have that positive sort of view of it. Now, does that going to give you a spiritual feeling when you do it? Probably not. Probably not. But that doesn't mean that it's not a mitzvah, like we said before. The many mitzvahs you can do without having a spiritual feeling. And in Hasidus, they say a very remarkable thing. They say, if you are forced by life to do a mitzvah, which is very difficult because there's no spiritual feeling there. If you do it without the spirituality feeling, and you feel like, you know, I'm forced to do this thing, and I hate it because there's no spirituality, it's not inspiring, but you know you have to do it because Hashem put you in that situation. A person, God forbid, to take care of somebody sick. They don't want to. It's not pleasant. There's no spirituality in that. No feeling, but it's a very difficult thing. So, Hashem gives people sometimes very difficult things to do. What makes it even more excruciatingly difficult is that I don't get a spiritual high by doing it. It's very tough, and it's not spirituality. So Hasidus says that really that mitzvah is the greatest mitzvah. So Hashem is testing you to see whether you're so loyal to Him and to the Torah that you will do it without an immediate payoff. Because in a certain way, getting back to the first discussion, spirituality, if I experience spirituality, it's a payoff. I like it. I feel good. Should feel good because it's a time for the neshama to feel a dveikus with Hashem. So the neshama mamish enjoys being close to Hashem, and if I'm aware of that, it's a time of gadol. So if a person does a mitzvah which gives him inspiration and a good feeling of spirituality, so he's enjoying it. So he's getting like a matan schar b'tzidra. He's getting the schar of the mitzvah mamish right away. Very good, and it's a big motivation. People want to get that feeling. It's a tanuk. And according to Moshe Chaim Lutzato, at the beginning of the Mesilas Yesharim, maybe that's the reason God even created him, to get that tanuk, that spiritual pleasure. Okay, but Hasidus says, if you don't get the spiritual pleasure, because you have to do something which is really not spiritual. You're taking care of a sick person, you're changing adult diapers in a hospital. There's no spirituality in that. There's no feeling of feeling good. It's terrible. So because you're doing something without the tanug, it's a greater mitzvah. Because it shows you, it's an indication of your mesiras nefesh, that you're so dedicated to Hashem and to the Torah that you're doing something because Hashem wants you to do it. Mamish, being like they call him being an Eved. An Eved does Vavadetzem. You have to serve Hashem as an Eved. An Eved doesn't do it for pleasure. An Eved is because he's loyal. He's absolutely loyal. He'll do the most unpleasant things because he wants his master to be happy. It's a function of his loyalty. So when a Jew does mitzvahs like that, it's a greater level, the Hasidish is from. It's a level of being an Eved. So when a guy goes into general studies, let's say Parnassa, other things, he's doing it because he's from the 80 out of the 100 who have no possibility of making it in Torah. He's definitely going out. He has to know Hashem wants him to serve him that way. He's not going to enjoy the spiritual. He's not going to come home and say, you know what? I had an aliyah. I went up the spiritual ladder. He may even come home and say, I went down the spiritual ladder. But I have no choice. I have to bring home a paycheck. I have to take care of my wife, take care of my children. I have to do this. So it might be even a greater mitzvah. Now, having said that there's an intellectual concept for a person to know. But having said that, as the second thing which a person has to know is something that we said before, that you have to do things with the maximum, and the maximum strategy to maximize the spirituality. So I say like this, I say, if you have to make a career choice, you have to look and see which career choice will give me the opportunity to maximize real spirituality. So if you take a choice, if you have different options, and one career, let's say, is going to be a 9-to-3 job, but you're going to make a basic income, but not great. Another job is a 9-to-9 job. Let's say a lawyer. Lawyer is 9-to-9. So 9-to-9 job, you're going to make much more money. But if you're doing 9-to-9 in the law firm, where's the time for Torah, mitzvahs? Okay, so intellectually, you know that since you're mechaber l'shem shemayim, you want to be able to use the income for family, for tzedakah, and so on. So pay tuitions. Okay, so intellectually you know you're doing a mitzvah, but you're not experiencing it. But if you would choose 9-to-3 and be a public school teacher, or a physical therapist, 9-to-3, so you're not going to make half of a lawyer, but you're going to make enough for a living. Meanwhile, you come home at 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, you can teach your children Torah, which is very spiritual. You can really give your wife personal attention and have the simcha of a good marriage, which is very spiritual feeling. You can do many things which are real, direct spiritual activities, not just an intellectual concept, but reality. So I think that a person, when he makes his career choice, has to put the spiritual side into the equation. It should be something which will allow him to feel, to have the feeling of Torah and mitzvah. It's not just, he knows he's doing a mitzvah. It's a theoretical thing. But meanwhile, he's in the crunching and grinding and just, you know, treading the treadmill and doing nothing spiritual about whatever he's doing. So there's a big issue with the boys. The boys, it's a very, tell you the truth, I feel very sad and by the way the boys make their choices. I don't think they think about this. They just really think about success. Success, I'm sorry to say, is a false idol. It's not... the world defines success. It's not the Jewish concept. So... it's a sad thing when I see the boys make choices without putting everything into the equation. You know what I'm saying?
So I guess as a follow-up, I would say, how about aside from Parnassa, let's say you're in a class, like, say an English literature class, it's really not going to, you know, romantic poetry is not really going to affect your Parnassa. And two, how would the Rav of Soloveitchik fit into this model of, like, the one out of 100 people or the, and so on and so forth?
Well, I think like this, when, the Rav, which is your second question, the first question, come back.
We could do them out of order, if that's
okay. Yeah, the Rav, and I don't know, I'm a great student of the Rav, you know, published a lot of Sfarim, but I think that with the Rav, the Rav was a man who was able to teach and to live himself with paradoxes. His theory of Torah and of the life was that paradox, which is something against basic logic, was within Torah logic. So like the theory of the two dinim doesn't mean that it's either or, it could be both. So he said that many times. Now, that, what does that mean for someone who wants to say, I'm a student of the Rav, and I want to, say, follow the Rav? Well, if the Rav is teaching a paradox, for example, he's saying, you must learn Torah on such a level that you're completely immersed in it every moment of your waking hour. Think about it when you walk, when you eat, even when you're talking to a person, part of your mind is still thinking about the Torah, Tosfos, which is what the Rambam himself describes a great time in Chacham. Even when he's talking to a person about the weather, but part of his mind is working on Torah, which is what the Rav was. Because I had a lot of conversations with him, it's been many years. He was the guy who could do that. So he's saying, on the one hand, Torah is 24/7. All your waking hours, even sleeping, he would say, you sleep and think Torah. That's one state. Then he says, on the other hand, secular knowledge is great, it's all from God, and you can get inspiration there. Well, you know, for normal people, everyday people, that's going to take time and mind. You can't do two things at the same time. If I'm going to spend an hour reading Shakespeare, it's not the hour reading the Rambam and Halacha. You can't do both. So the Rav teaches you a paradox. So what happens when the Rav teaches you a paradox, which many times, he says, Israel is the greatest thing in the world. And then you ask him, should I move? He says, no, don't move to Israel. It's better to stay in America. So he teaches you all kinds of paradoxes. So what happens when there's a paradox? So you get the following. The most obvious outgrowth of teaching paradox, or teaching paradoxes, is that you get students who pick one of the two. No one, and see, there's another thing. The Rav himself apparently enjoyed paradox. But most of us don't. Most of us like a simple, you know, black, white, multicolored, but we know what we're doing, we know what we're thinking about. We don't like paradox. The human being has a natural aversion to paradox. You have to have a great, I don't know, philosophy or mind to say paradox is essential, it's mental, and I like it. Rav liked it. He liked very much to demon, paradox. And I'm writing now the Shulman Yevam. This is full of these paradoxes, which the Rav, he loved them. Is she married? Is she not married? Is she partially married? Is there so many different paradoxes? So many didn't hear or didn't hear paradox. So he likes that. But 99% of people do not like to live in a paradox. So what happens is that 99% of the students of the Rav pick on all of these different issues one or the other. So either they'll, let's say in the Torah general studies thing, So one Talmud will say, the Rav taught us only Torah. General studies was of the Be'eved. Another guy says, the Rav taught us you must put head and shoulders and everything into general studies, because general studies is also God's will, and it's being in this world, and that's Kiddush Hashem, and all the good reasons. Both heard something from the Rav to give them that message. So I can't really tell you, you know, the Rav gave us a clear road through this paradox of Torah studies, general studies. There's no clear road at all. It's very paradoxical. I personally go for the Torah and the general studies for the Parnassah. I don't accept for myself the idea that general studies is a study which is worthwhile to replace time spent on Torah. Because for me, my mind is a one-dimensional in that sense. I know the Rav, I know him a little bit, and I can say that from what I saw with the Rav, his mind could work two tracks at the same time. I have no doubt about it. A lot of times I spoke to him about A, and then in a second he's telling me something very deep about B, which has nothing to do with A. His mind is working on two tracks, so fine. Maybe about Liechtenstein and Israel is that kind of a head he can do. I myself am very limited. I'm a small fry, and I only work one track at a time. Now, when I got my PhD, which the Rav told me to do, so I went and I got it with a lot of parental pressure. For me, it was taking time away from Torah. And I did it only because of Parnassah. And I used it for 5-6 years. I was a teacher of math in City College before I became a Rebbe. So for me, the PhD gave me Parnassah. That's what I went for. But the Rav meant, I have no idea, because I'm not at that level to deal with his dualities. So that's why I say like this. To me, so if you ask me a question about English literature, if, getting back to that first question now, because I think we have to went through the Rav first. If English literature, the college requires it, so for me to have Parnassa as a lawyer or as a doctor or a computer programmer, I've got to do what the college requires. So that English literature becomes part of my Parnassa studies. I've got to get the piece of paper. But if it's not required, I would never take it as a choice. I would take and maximize whatever Torah I could do. And if I took more courses, it would be in my major. So let's say I have a free 3 credits, but I maxed out in Torah. I can't take Shir, I can't take it. So I take the 3, I'm a computer major. I'll take an advanced course in computers to be a better programmer. It's all part of the Parnassah. I wouldn't, you know, be a dilettante and say I want to broaden my view of the world and be more of a romantic scholar. And they call them a universal person, which is what liberal arts. I never agreed with the whole philosophy of a liberal arts college. When I was here, this college was only liberal arts. There was, before there was ever Cy Sims, there wasn't even a computer major in my day. In my day, when you came to Yeshiva College, you had to be liberal arts. The only thing you could do, which was outside liberal arts, you could do a math, which is what I did, and you could do a pre-med, which the other boys did. No business, no computers. I thought it was crazy. I don't agree with a liberal arts education. What's the point in a liberal arts education? To get people to know the philosophy and the culture of the Goyim? And replace that time that I could be learning the philosophy and culture of the Torah. We're not dealing with people over here who know Kol HaTorah Kula. The Rav, when he was till the age of 29, the Rav only learned Torah. When he was 29, he went through Shas many times, and he knew it very deep level. He had a very big desire to learn what the nations of the world say. And he went to college, university, so. We're not like the Rav. We don't have that. We're really simple people. Till we'll know all of Shas even once, even doing Daf Yomi would take us 7 years. And very few can do that. So till we'll know Shas even once would take us 15 years to an Amid a day. So every hour I take for English literature voluntarily is an hour taken away from Torah, Musa, Hasidus. I don't think that that's that makes sense. It doesn't make sense, because why do we have to do that? We have to maximize our Torah, our Judaism, our Avodas Hashem, and make Parnassa. So whatever we have to do for Parnassa, we do, because that's a mitzvah. But we're not going, I don't believe that there's any substitution from the nations of the world which can replace our responsibility to maximize our Torah and our spirituality. And the way I see it is, if a person voluntarily at this stage, whether it's me, whether it's a Talmud, whether it's anybody that I know, except maybe I can count on the fingers of less than one hand geniuses like the Rav, but for 99.99% of the people that I know, adults, younger people, etc., for us regular, normal people who have one-track minds, we can only work on one thing at a time, and we don't know enough Torah, and we don't serve Hashem properly, we don't have enough Avodas Hashem. We have to maximize our Torah and our Avodas Hashem, the time, the zman that we put into it. We have to spend more time in the Beis Medrash, more time in Shir, more time going to experiences of Torah and Yiddishkeit outside, going back to Eretz Yisrael, to the yeshiva, going to the Knesset, the Shtiebel in Brooklyn, whatever is involved, going to anything which increases our Torah and mitzvahs and our spirituality. That's what we have to do. We're not here to prove that someone can know a lot of Torah and also know a lot of Plato or Shakespeare. That's been proven already. You see, I think when the Rav was young, the Jews, the Frum Jews, were first beginning to go to university. And at that time, back in around the year 1900 or so, 1910, 20, whenever he went, the early 20th century, the Jews were coming out of the masses, they were coming out of the state and coming to the big cities of Europe. And the irreligious Jews, the Maskilim, who had left even earlier, they were claiming you couldn't remain frum and be secular. They claimed if you wanted to be secular, which bottom line meant panosa, to break out of the shtetl and get into the big world of Vienna or Paris or London, you had to be like the guy. So they threw away their Yiddishkeit and got the secular education and kept a certain level of Jewish culture. That was the maskilim. So in those years when the Rav went, there was a huge cultural, social, and intellectual challenge to show that a person could go to the university and learn everything in the university and stay frum. And that's what the Rav did. He went to show, I'm a huge Talmud Chacham and I'm going to go and study everything the Goyim have, Hegel and Aristotle and Plato and Nietzsche and everything, and I'm going to remain the big Talmud Chacham to show it. So he did it. And then Yeshiva University. So at the beginning of the 20th century, there was this big issue of transition. Can someone come out of the cloister and protected environment of the Jewish shtetl and come into the big world, learn general studies, and stay Orthodox? So in that, in the Shem Shemefel Hirsch in Germany, worked on that issue. So on that issue, there was a special need to really expose the person who wanted to do that to everything. He should read Shakespeare, he should do English literature, do everything, to show that whatever you read, it's not going to make you not from. You know, you can assimilate it and work it into your Jewish identity and Jewish practice. You can do it.
But they didn't believe that it was worthy in and of itself.
No, once you do it, you do learn something, okay? Shakespeare tells me some lessons about the human condition. Aristotle and Plato will tell me certain things about, let's say, nature and how the world operates. There's no question about it. So fine, you do learn something worthwhile, and you can, you know, spin it into Avodas Hashem. There's no question. But that wasn't the point. The point was to prove and demonstrate that you can stay religious and committed to Torah and expose yourself to anything. However, we're living now in the year 2008. We're living at least 100 years after that was an issue. By now, we have literally millions of people who have studied everything, whether it's philosophy or medicine or whatever you want, and they have remained Torah Jews. This is not an issue for us today. We don't have to prove that you can study English literature and stay religious. I don't have to prove that. It's been proven. That's not the issue. We don't have the issue of the Haskalah today. In other words, we the Orthodox, as a community, our issue today is not that my students or my children are being so attracted by the non-Jewish world's intellectual expressions that if I don't tell them or show them that you can stay religious and do that, they're going to run away, which is what the Maskilim did. That's not the issue today. We don't have that problem at all. Our problem today is what you spoke about at the beginning. We are committed. We have general studies as Parnassa and without any ifs, buts, holds, barred. If your Parnassa is going to be a professor of philosophy, so fine, so go study philosophy. No one has a problem with that. That's your Parnassa. If your Parnassa is going to be studying English literature, if your Parnassa is going to be teaching English in high school, so go study that. No one has a problem with that. Anything you want to study, if it's Parnassa, go ahead and do it. We don't have an issue with studying secular studies, which was the big issue at the turn of the 20th century. For us, it's second hand. Everybody studies secular studies today. They come from Lakewood. Hasidim are in graduate schools. You go into hospitals, you see Hasidic doctors with beards and payers, and they're doctors. Certainly Yeshiva University has no problem with that. So the issue which Yeshiva University itself was founded to address, when it was founded 70 plus years ago, it was still at the sort of an American Haskalah was very strong. There was a very strong reform, a very strong conservative movements, and these movements at that time were saying you cannot be Orthodox if you want to be secular. Means Parnassa. So they use the Parnassa as a hook. You want to be secular because you want to make money in the big world, so drop Orthodoxy. So Yeshiva University was created to show, no, we have philosophy, we have English literature, we have this, we have liberal arts. Well, 100% religious is no problem. So Yeshiva did that for 30, 40, 50 years. Now we've reached the point that tens of thousands of graduates, I don't know what the number is, but it's certainly over 50,000. And you have Israel, Bar Ilan, and you have all over America, University of Penn, University of Maryland, Harvard, Yale, everybody with the amicus learning whatever they have to learn. That's not an issue. I don't have to prove that. The conservative reform are not a hook for anybody. No one, no Orthodox boy is going to say, I'm going to throw away the religion because it's going to help me make a living. That's ridiculous. People laugh at such a statement. Why will an Orthodox boy today throw away the religion? Because he says, it's boring, it's dry, it doesn't have meaning to me, he doesn't experience the religion. I don't understand Gemara, I don't know what's going on. So it's the religion itself which is the issue. We have to give our boys a full exposure to the religion. That's what the issue is. Secular side is not an issue at all. The secular side today has become nothing but a tool in the person's life. It's not a religious issue. I don't see any point in beating what I call a dead horse. I have to prove that we can read English literature and stay religious. it's not an issue. If English Yiddish is going to give me panasa, good. If it's not panasa, I don't need it. I have to learn more Torah. I've got to get more religious experience because I have to remain committed. I have to teach my children to be committed. I have to have a more vibrant Judaism. That's the issue today. So, you know, Chanocho now Pidako. Just because something was an issue 50, 70 years ago doesn't mean it has to stay an issue forever. Why is that? Why do we have to pledge allegiance to an old cause, which is not relevant anymore? It's not a relevant cause. The cause today is, how do I make Judaism for people who are religious and people who are not religious an attractive experience? That's the cause. To focus on Torah, focus on mitzvahs, and make them more real.
So I guess now to shift gears, just the last two things that I wanted to ask are questions 6 and 7 about tefillah and tshuva, especially because they're so apropos right now.
The God through tefillah and then tshuva. And things like this. It fits very well to what I'm saying. The experiential side of the Torah, the Judaism. Now, I said at the beginning that unfortunately, and probably if you want to tie the whole thing together, unfortunately today, but maybe it was fortunately 30, 40, 50 years ago, the Torah education in America focused on the intellectual side of Torah, not on the experiential side. And probably because it was fundamentally shaped as a response to the Haskalah. Because the Haskalah, the secular side of the Jewish people, was saying, oh, you're intellectually inferior to us. You don't expose yourself to all the wisdom of the world. You're very narrow. So therefore, our response was, the Orthodox, no, we're super intellectual, we're right up there at the top, and, you know, the Torah learning, really, the Torah learning also became very intellectual, very abstract, with the Brisker and the Yeshivish, and Yeshiva University came up with the liberal arts college. So it was a response, really, to the challenges of the world. I'm not, I don't want to say just to those Jewish liberal, left-wing, secular intellectuals. The world itself was challenging the Jews with that. So that was the response. That was fortunate for those years that Jews made a yeshiva university, American Jews made yeshiva high schools, and they created top-of-the-line intellectual systems. So you can go to Maimonides in Boston for high school, and then you wind up in Harvard. How can anyone come and say we're intellectually inferior? If Harvard accepts more from all the schools in the country, public and private, Maimonides of Boston, which was the Rav school, had percentage-wise the most acceptances into Harvard. And the dean of admissions in Harvard said, a Maimonides student, I snap up. But it could be a prep school in New York City, he doesn't snap up. So we proved, and the Rav school and Maimonides proved more than maybe any other school, that intellectually you could be completely orthodox and be a successful intellectual. So what happened? Education in the high schools, and because of that, the elementary schools, became completely focused on the intellect. Teach boys or girls, teach them this, teach them that, they should know. Tests. What happened to experience? What happened to lay? Gone. Completely gone. That wasn't the focus. Now, as I said, we're 50, 70, 80, 100 years after that intellectual challenge. Right now, that's not our challenge. We've proven in hundreds of thousands of ways that people can be B'nai Torah and be great intellects in the secular world, lawyers, doctors, philosophers, whatever you want. The challenge today is that this flawed, because today I'm saying for today's generation, this flawed educational system, which focused on the intellect of Judaism and ignored the heart and and soul of Judaism is producing spiritual cripples. Our boys and our girls are cripples, spiritual cripples. They have a good head, they're trained in thinking, and maybe they can read a text nicely, but they have no, they're infants in their religious sensitivities and their feelings and their antennas. They're completely like blind bats. So we have to shift gears to a new agenda, namely a total Jewish experience and education. Education has to move from just intellect to being a total immersion in Torah and Judaism. That's what Israel, that 1 year in Israel, does for a lot of boys and girls. All of a sudden, wow, I like this. All of a sudden, there's a feeling. They come back to America, so it has to be continued, it has to be nurtured. That's the challenge today, the way I see it. That's the challenge. So, getting to tefillah and tshuva are the expressions of that challenge, of that lathe. So, I personally feel that showing, now things like this, how do you teach tefillah, tshuva, which may say, how do you teach lathe, the feeling for Judaism? So Rabbi Soloveitchik said very honestly, many, many times in his writings and his speeches, that he has no idea how to do it. And now, in hindsight, I say, maybe for that generation, that wasn't the thing that you had to teach. So what he had to do was the intellect. He did a superb job. But he said he feels that he said many times, he said he feels he's a failure. And that he said, I'm not going to say you shouldn't teach it. I think it should be taught, but I have no concept, and I consider myself a failure, he said, in that area. So I've been thinking about this a long time. That it's so important to teach people the La'avda B'chol Levavcha. Now, how do you do that? Well, you do it really, I think, two ways. One, there's, you still have that intellectual, in other words, you can focus intellectually on the lathe. You can read certain books which are giving you inspiration. You can read books or hear lectures which will talk about it and give you an intellectual focus on it. That's one thing. But obviously that is not going to satisfy the need, because it's got to move from the brain into the heart. The brain can know a lot of things and can think about it, but it still doesn't get into the heart. Now, the way you get it into the heart is actually, it's very, because we're dealing in the world, the Yeshiva University world, where this has never been addressed, literally has not been on the agenda. Forget about that it's been addressed the wrong way. It's not on the agenda. It's not in the syllabus. We have never had a meeting. I'm a Rebbe here for maybe 40 years or so. I've never had one meeting with any other Rebbe administration. How do we produce among our Talmidim Avodas Hashem? How do we get people to serve Hashem? Not just know about it, but to do it. Not once. It's not on the agenda. So, it's a very difficult issue to address if a person like me, who realizes this immense, incredible need and literally of tragic proportions, the situation which is out there, how do you address it? How do I address that? As one person, how do I address that? I don't know what to say in terms of what an institution can do. But what I say is that besides the intellect, okay, you study this, study that. You have to, people have to have experiences which produce the spiritual experience. Besides intellect, I read this Musa book, I read that Hasidus book. It has to be an experience. Well, I find that Kumsitz music is a very powerful spiritual experience which will inspire people. That's what I do. I mean, for myself, I know that the different Kumsitz and turn off the lights, sit there, have a slow song, you know, different kind of a song, and then tell a nice story with an inspiration, storytelling, music. This is a method which gets you to spirituality. So talk about tefillah, tshuva. I think you can learn about tefillah and tshuva. I mean, we spent last year learning Masechta Brachos. You can read the Rambam Hilchos Tshuva. Definitely do the intellectual thing. But to get to the feeling, the experience, you have to do things which create that more directly. So if a guy gets a good kumsitz with a good story, that can bring him to do tshuva on the spot. And NCSY, you see, NCSY is a tshuva movement. They use the kumsitz story, Nigin method is a very powerful way to get kids to connect. It's the same thing. It's too bad that they don't have such a program. I mean, a real program here. But anyway, I try to do a little bit. When I boy came to me the other day, he just come back from Israel, so I'd have this Thursday night Hasidus. So first of all, and we do the intellectual side, so we're focusing intellectually on Chassidus, which is the side of Avodas Hashem we spoke about before, the positive of it. But then I make a kumsitz, and then we have a rikud, we dance. And a boy came to me a couple of days ago, yesterday, 2 days ago, and he says, I just came back from Israel. He says, wow, I found a place with lathe, I found a place with a heart. Why? I said, why? He says, well, you make a record, you dance around. So these are the things, you know, that's very important. Now, another thing I wanted to say, talk about tefillah specifically. I think that the boys here don't know how to daven at all. I talk in generalities. There are obviously boys here and there who can. But I would say, if I had to rate tefillah and YU A to D, and D is failing, give it a D. They're dabbing only with their intellect. They're only saying the words you have to say. The feeling is close to zero. Rarely, it's going to be very hard for me to remember in the 40 years that I saw a boy crying by dabbing. It's crazy. I don't understand. David HaMelech is crying so much in Tehillim. I grew up in a steeple with European fellows crying all the time. I came to IU with Bubba Licious, was crying so many times. How can someone not cry when he's davening? I can't understand. It means not davening. You know you're talking to your Abba. Your Abba is going to help you. I don't understand it. That just means to me that these people are not really davening with their heart. It's just words. Maybe so. I'm not saying it's not a mitzvah. Saying the words, you understand the words, it's a mitzvah, but it's very, very, it's not the mitzvah that the Rambam and the Gemara said we should do. Tears are not part of a lathe. Reminds me of a Hasidish story that there once was a king and he wanted to go through a gate, and the watchman of the gate the king was a lion, that's the story. The lion must go through a gate, he's the king, and the watchman above the gate is a donkey. So the donkey says to the king, pay me the money that the cost to go through, the dollar. He says, me? I'm the king. I don't have to pay a dollar. Like he says, yes you do. It says right here in the book, everybody has to pay a dollar. I don't care what you are. So the lion takes a paw and bangs the donkey over the head and kills him. So he had an advisor there, and he goes through. So the advisor, the fax, says, why did you do that? You know, he's a stupid donkey. Why do you have to kill him? He says, I know donkeys are stupid, but donkeys have a heart. This donkey doesn't have a heart. You'll see, cut him open. Cut open the donkey. Oh, well, there was no heart in the donkey. He only had a liver. The king says, you see? Point like this. If you don't understand something intellectually, but at least you have a heart, that donkey should have seen the king. If he has a heart, he'd bow down, he'd be afraid. No, he's so intellectual. He has something in the book. Same thing with davening. A person davens with his mind, but not with his heart. He never cries. His davening is just to get to say all the words. Speed read through the davening. He's not talking to his Father in heaven. I don't know who he's addressing. He's being Yotzei the Shulchan Aruch. But it's not in the tefillah of experience. It's not what the Chazal wants. It's not what the Torah wants. So the first thing in tefillah is to seek out a slow minyan. If 90% of the boys here look for the quickest minyan, that means they're not doing tefillah for leiv. It's only the malach. You have to look for the slowest possible minyan. When you go for a ma'ariv, I can't take this. I go into a ma'ariv in the dormitory many times, and there's a certain ma'ariv, I don't know if I should say which one, but there's a certain ma'ariv in a certain dormitory that they have to finish the whole thing within 5 minutes. It's crazy. In 5 minutes for a ma'ariv? It's unbelievable. He's saying Kaddish Tiskabel at 11:05. So it's an 11 o'clock minute. I can't believe it. So when I came in last night to that ma'ariv, I told the guy, every night somebody else, but they have a tradition, it has to be fun. I told the guy, you daven slow tonight, because I'm here. So instead of finishing at 11:05, look at the clock, they finished at 11:08. They did it in 8 minutes, did me a favor. Ridiculous. Well, talking to your Father in heaven, people are sick. I can't understand that. You want to somehow persuade Hashem to give a refuah to somebody. So how are you going to do that zipping through the words? Don't you want to talk to God and say, you know, my friend is not well. He's a good boy. It takes time. You want to persuade. I don't understand. So I think that the first thing with tefillah is that they have to choose a minyan which davens slow. The slower, the better. It gives you time to talk to God. So, not speed. If you see a minyan which is speeding, don't go there. Take the slowest minyan. If you get into a minyan where you know that they're going to speed, you go to the amid, you take the amid, be the shliach tzibur, and you go through it slow. Don't be ashamed. No one is a boss over here about the speed. There's no such a thing. We have no bylaws in Yeshiva College catalog. Ma'ariv should take 5 minutes. And no one says anything. Whoever takes the Amid, he's the one who decides. You have to always find slow. If you're going to go to Minyan and you know that Minyan is going to speed, take the Amid and dive in slow. They scream at you, so it's their problem. I never believe in this. You know, sometimes I take the Amid. They made a joke once at a Purim spiel about me. They said that someone was passing by the rumor I was a shliach tzibur, and they said the other guy, they told him the spiel. Oh, Rabbi, I see Rabbi Reichman is a shliach tzibur. He's driving mincha. It's a little early for mincha. So I don't know if it's chatzos. So he says no. He's still davening shachris. When did he start? Oh, he started at 8:00, and now it's 12:00. So I was happy they made that kind of a joke, because it means good, Baruch Hashem, you see, I'm a slow davener. So they tell me, oh, you daven for the Amid, certain boys say you're too slow. Sorry, I have to have an experience. You have to have the experience, not just me. You think it's too slow? Oh. Make your own minyan, go someplace else. We have to have people davening, believe. And slow is the key. That's number. That's the tefillah. Now, when it comes to tshuva, that's a whole different discussion. Tshuva, You know, I recommend for tshuva that you read the sefer that they published called Al HaTshuva from the Rav, because it's a very wonderful sefer. It really talks about a lot of different things about tshuva. But the thing with tshuva, which I just want to say one small point, because it, you know, it's a limitless topic. The point I make with tshuva is that we're going into Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. So Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, especially Yom Kippur, the goal is perfection. The goal is to achieve perfection. But very, 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 very few are ever going to come close to perfection. So I think like this, that in Yom Kippur, if you want perfection, then Hashem is ready to accept that as tshuva. The whole year, tshuva actually is maybe more demanding. Taka says, if you do a certain sin, you have to stop doing it and do what's right. Okay, so, you know, we have our successes and we have our failures on regular tshuva. Yom Kippur is a gift. Hashem says, because you want to do good, even though you know you're not going to be able to, but you really want to, and you're crying about it, then Hashem says, I will forgive you. I will give you the clean bill just for wanting to do good. That's what I heard from Rabbi Soloveitchik many times, and I think that that's a very good attitude to have. People think, people who don't know that secret, a lot of people think that the Yom Kippur Vidui is exaggerated. It's too demanding. How will I ever achieve all of this? Never to speak Lashon Hara, never to look at a woman in the wrong way, never to eat sometimes something not kosher. I mean, these things are like very, very, very difficult. So, if you know that, it's not that you're not expected to achieve. What you are expected is to want to get there and to try. You're only a human being. You will fail along the way, so you try again. As long as you want to try and you want to say, I will continue to try, that's all Hashem wants from Yom Kippur. He's not asking you to achieve. The whole year, I think, is a higher standard. Hashem really would like to see people do it the right way. But I think on Yom Kippur, which is like cleans the slate, is Hashem says, you know, you're trying and I'm going to clean the slate, you start all over again. So just for having the Ratzon, the person gets kapara from Yom Kippur. So that's all I want to say about you. Okay?
Thank you very, very much, Avraham.